That was great, James. Remember, yeah, my fifth step was the next.
What was that guy's name again?
Go to the back. I rolled over like jello. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. My name's Paulie. And if you know where you're coming back, welcome home. You're off the hook, and that's always told to me a long time ago. It's great to see so many people here. Because actually, I like to see people that want to get sober. And if you want to get sober, we got the answers. I don't have the answers. We have the answers. Mark, that was a great job. Did you write that? It's just that you talked it so slow. I mean, with that accent, I might not have understood it when I got here. But no, I can't talk Southern because I sound black when I talk. Anyway, we may get a little information tonight and we may have a couple of laughs. But the reality is, at least by 8:30, probably none of us will get loaded. You know, this program is a real simple program. It's 12 steps. Now, I know a lot of us complicate it, but it's only 12 steps. And the only thing that we have to do perfectly that I was told is the first half of the first step. We admitted we were powerless over booze and drugs. I'm looking here, and it's definitely booze and drugs. And Krista, don't worry about that. Half the people here want to say that, they just don't know. So that's a truth, and a truth is never going to change. You're powerless the day you get here, you're going to be powerless till the day you die. But the second half of that first step, that our lives had become unmanageable, that's a fact. And a fact does and will change if you stay sober. When we get here, when I got here, my life was so unmanageable, it was unbearable, it was unimaginable. And by the grace of God and you people, I found a manager. And that's what the second step says. It's no real rocket science. We came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Now, the real simple thing would be that if you're drinking or you're using and you get sober for a little period of time, and then you go back to drink or use, that's insanity. Because even thinking that it's going to be a little different. I mean, I've watched so many people do that. And I thank God that when I got here, I surrendered. Totally, unconditionally surrendered. There's no question in my mind I cannot use and I cannot drink. Of course, it's going to get very bad very quickly. And yet, I've watched so many people that can't get that into their head. I wish that I could strangle somebody. No, I'm serious. You know, oftentimes we do the Lord's Prayer, and we used to, Mike and I talk about this all the time. We used to hug, and so I'd be putting my hand on someone, you know, that was really bouncing in and out and couldn't get it. And I wanted in my own mind to say, please God, can't this guy get a little bit of what you gave me? Because I'm a hope to die dope fiend alcoholic. I should not be here. By his grace, you people, I'm here. So I don't get the other piece, you know. Obviously, there's a lot of people here that came on those vans. I'm going to write a book. I was thinking about this last week. The van people. No, I'm serious. There's people that come down to Florida from New York or New Jersey. And when did you get here? I got here in 2000. I said, really? I said, where have you been for the 15 years? I've been in treatment. I said, what do you mean you've been in treatment? This is 2015. And then he goes on 27 places he's been. That is a van person. A person who likes to hear the call, time to get on the van. Really, you don't need to live on a van. You don't need to live with strange women. I mean, the men can, but not you girls. And that's the other thing. Before this has nothing to do with the third step. But a couple of women were talking to me before the meeting, and they were talking to some guys, and You know, like how you look, you know, like you could tell when the endorphins are going. Yeah. Let me help everybody in here, only because of my experience. You're all young and you got those testosterones running and the chicks and you're gorgeous. And just imagine this, whether you're a man or a woman, just look at the other person's forehead. Don't look at the body and what you want to do. It's just look at the forehead and imagine in big red blinking neon letters, S-I-C-K. Now, if you can remember that, it will save so much grief. I mean, really, what's the point? I mean, I see people in treatment. Oh, yeah. I mean, they're like engaged on the couch in the treatment. Anyway, if you're here, you've hit enough of a bottom. You don't need to go any lower. You know, in all of our literature, and certainly if you get sober and you stay sober and you start studying our literature, which I've done, and they have books like AA Comes of Age and Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers and Pass It On. And in AA Comes of Age, it talks about surrender being a disciplinary experience. And it talks about surrender later on in sobriety, how it never stops. But before you can get to the later on in sobriety, you've got to do the first surrender. And the first surrender is you can't pick up no matter what. And I'll tell you what, I thank God, I really thank God that I got beaten up so badly before I got here that I walked into my first meeting and I said, thank you, I'm home. And I knew it, I felt it, and nothing's happened since then to change that feeling. You know, I was thinking about this tonight. I was in New York 8 or 10 years ago. And by the way, if anybody has a hearing problem, that's where I'm from, in New York. And I was there speaking at a meeting, at an anniversary, at a Thanksgiving celebration in Queens, New York. And I happened to say during my talk about the gift of desperation. I don't say that all the time. I happen to say I'm grateful that I had the gift of desperation when I got here and that I still do. Well, here's what happened. Some guy, so then we break, I finished and we break for cigarettes and we come back in and some guy has his hand raised and I call on him. He says, you're not gonna believe it. He says, the gift of desperation was my home group in Long Island 5 years ago. I said, wow, that's cool. He says, yeah. And then we of course called it the gift of desperation because it was G-O-D. So I'm sitting there shaking my head. And I said, yeah, of course. Now, let me just follow up for a minute. I had 20-something years sobriety when this happened. And I'm sitting in the front of the room and we're going around the rest of the meeting. And the whole time I'm sitting up there and I'm saying, I just lied to this whole room of people. I didn't know that gift of desperation was G-O-D. I never heard that gift of desperation was G-O-D. Every time my sponsor would say it to me, but of course, this guy said it. So, hey, anything you know, I knew before you. As a matter of fact, most of what you knew, I wrote. And so I'm sitting there and I'm shaking my head. Finally, I guess I was sober long enough that I couldn't let it end like that. So before the meeting ended, I said, look, I got to tell you guys something. I said, you know, when that guy shared about the gift of desperation being G-O-D, and I made like I knew what it was, I never heard that. I said, for 20-something years, my sponsors were telling me that, and I never heard that gift of desperation was G-O-D. So I told them, and blah, blah, blah. I went outside after the meeting. Now, Ray and Fred were both dead. May they rest in peace. I went outside after the meeting, and I called everyone in Florida either that I sponsored or that people that knew this saying, not one of them knew that the gift of desperation was G-O-D. So to this very day, I don't know whether Fred T. knew the gift of desperation was G-O-D. And I'm sure I'm going to ask him whenever I get to wherever it is he went. But I hope it's not tomorrow. Anyway, the key is that that's it. Gift of desperation, G-O-D, group of drunks, group of drug addicts, whatever. A lot of other things. Group of degenerates. So, you know, a lot of people, we come here and people tell me, I can't come to believe. I can't believe there's any power greater than myself. And when I realized that a little shot glass or a little glassine envelope could kick my ass, I realized that was a power greater than myself. But then about the believing and the faith and all of this thing, and my sponsor told me, he says, Paul, when you were on the Lower East Side of Manhattan and you were up in Harlem, did you ever go to a door and put some money in the peephole and not knowing what was coming out? I said, well, sure, that's the way I ran my whole life. He says, well, you were believing in something. You were believing that Flacco was going to put something through that peephole. And then I realized that it was made very simple to me. Everybody here ever hear of Thomas Edison? Even the alcoholics? Everybody? Christy, you heard him? He's the guy who invented the light bulbs. No, seriously, I mean, I know that some towns, did they teach that in North Carolina? Oh, you don't even have light bulbs there yet, probably. I understand that well. So anyway, here's what I was able to think of, and it made so much sense to me, and in many, many ways, that this, first of all, in the fact of failure, this guy was a professional failure. He tried 800 and something different attempts to create the light bulb until he finally got it working. Okay, I mean, I could just imagine, because I like to put myself back there. Imagine, they were living on the west coast of Florida, and his wife, let's call her Martha, and she's downstairs, well, he's downstairs doing these experiments, and she says, Tom, would you give it up already? Come on, you need to make a living. Martha, I know I'm very close. I'm going to take care of it. So anyway, he invents the light bulb, which has changed the entire direction of the world. Now, I don't understand how that works. I have no idea. But I'm going to tell you what I do know. That when I get home tonight, I'm going to walk in my apartment, and I'm going to flip a switch. And I've come to believe that flipping that switch is going to make my life simpler. I've come to believe that this power of electricity that I do not understand allows my life to be more manageable. I've come to believe in something that I can't explain, just like God. I can't tell you. God is so infinite that for me to even try to explain it would be absurd. So the only way you're going to come to believe, in my opinion, is experientially. Unless you have like that white light experience, some people have it, I didn't. Some people had somebody come in their bedroom and it wasn't like a chick. It was just like, you know, I remember Zeke used to say, yeah, the thing, the bathroom lit up. I think he had too much acid, but my bedroom never lit up. But here's along this lighting, this electricity thing, imagine trying to live without it. See, that's the way I look at my power today. I can no more do without my power that I choose to let and help me run my life than I could do without electricity. Because if I go home tonight and my electric is turned off or there's a power outage or whatever the case may be, I'm going to be stumbling around. I'm not going to know where the table is, where the chair is, where the So what's happened is this power greater than myself has made my life simpler. Not only has it made it simpler, but I've come to rely on it. I've come to depend on it, and I don't understand it. So that's sort of like blind faith in something I don't understand that has been proven over and over and over again in my life. So if you just keep it as simple as that, when you go home tonight and you put on the light switch, you say, well, thank you. And thank you, by the way, is some of the greatest prayers you could possibly ever say. Instead of please and all of this other crap, just say thank you. Because you're acknowledging that you've already been given the gift. You know, in 1984, before most of you were born, 84, what's that, 31 years ago? Wow. Yeah, none of you guys were born. Most of the, right? Most of the van people were born in the 90s. Well, Mike, we know, was born in the 1890s. But here's what happened. I'm going to tell you this story because it's an example of the power. And I like to say that, or I was told, that coincidence is God's way of remaining anonymous. And this is what happened in 1984. I was at the 101 Club, which is where I got sober, and I was bringing this new guy. This new guy met me at the meeting. And he was brand new, and he was a junkie and an alcoholic. And it seemed to me that one of the people at the 101 was really nasty towards him for being a drug addict, you know, whatever. And I was already involved in the program, so I had a little juice by this time. And I got pissed off, because here this guy is first meeting. I was flying to New York that afternoon. And in our writings, it tells us that if you have a resentment, which I had toward this guy, you take a pen and a piece of paper. It says a waste paper basket also, which I didn't have. And I wrote this long letter to whom it may concern. And I put it in my attaché case. And I get to New York City the next day, and I'm walking around, and my appointment at 11-something cancels. It's in the winter. I have my attaché case, my winter coat, and I'm right down the block from Inner Group of General Service of Alcoholics Anonymous on Park Avenue South. So I say, well, I'm going to go there. So it's 11:30 on a Friday morning. I walk in there. And I say to the receptionist, I say, look, I'm here, I'm an AA member from Florida, and I have a resentment, and I need to speak with someone. She looks at me, she says, you're in luck. I said, what do you mean? On the sixth floor, which is the grapevine floor, like this is where all of AA happens in this building. On the sixth floor, Friday, between 11 and 12, we have the AA meeting for everybody that works here. So they're all there. I said, wow, that's great. So I go up with my attaché case with the letter in it, my winter coat in my arm like this, and I walk into this meeting 35 minutes after it started at 11:35. And it's this big conference room, and everybody's real dressed and impressive looking. And at the head of the table was this guy, Frank. And as I walked in the meeting, he says, oh, great, our speaker has arrived. Now, I don't know how many people have gone to an AA meeting 35 minutes late in a strange town and been asked to speak. So obviously the wind was taken out of my sails a little bit, but I spoke, I told a little about the resentment. Some woman downstairs said, come down to my office, let's talk. I gave her a copy of the letter. We'll fast forward 3 months. I got a letter from the International Convention of Alcoholics Anonymous in Montreal, Canada. And it was dated January or February of 1985. And it said, dear Paul, because of situations like that, in Fort Lauderdale, this is 30 years ago. For the first time ever, we're having a panel at the International Convention on Dual Addiction in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we'd like you to be on that panel. So because of this resentment, I ended up being on a panel in the World Convention of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1985 in Montreal, Canada. And Fred was with me and Ray was with me. We had about 40 people from the 101 Club. So God's hand was working way, way back. You know, God draws straight lines with crooked sticks. I told you last week the story of Perry, you know, and Italy, and I called him afterwards. I mean, you know, how's it possible that he has 14 years sober and I met his boss in Italy? I mean, it's just not really possible. You know, in what we read here, what Mark read, it ends with, it says that God could and would if we were sought. Those are the three steps, you know, the first three steps, A, B, and C, that we were alcoholic, could not manage our own lives, first step, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism, second step, that God could and would if he was sought, third step. The next line in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says the following: being convinced I'm trying to remember what the line said. Being convinced we were now at step three. That's what it says, black and white. So if you go through that, how it works, every day you're listening to it, the next line says, all right, now you're ready for step three. And what's step three? It's no mumbo jumbo. It may sound like a heavy step. We made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him, but it means nothing more than it's a decision. Okay, you're sick and tired of being sick and tired of living the way you're living. So make a decision and try to change. And what does that involve? It involves finding a sponsor and asking that sponsor to help you through the rest of the steps. That's my opinion. I'm going to tell you a story about sponsorship and about Ray. Ray Allen's sobriety date was March 23rd, 1956. And he was chairman of Bill Wilson's gratitude dinner in New York City, which is where he got sober. Ray bounced in and out of this program for quite some time. And then he finally, was not drinking. Not that he was sober, but he wasn't drinking. And he was going to their meeting they had on 24th Street in Manhattan, and he was going to this group in Brooklyn. And some guy came up to him after the meeting one day, and he gave him his phone number on a piece of paper. And he said, here, Ray, I want you to call me before you pick up that first drink. And Ray looked at him and says, what are you talking about, Tom? I haven't had a drink in 3.5 years. Why would you be giving me this? I'm not going to drink. I'm sober. And the guy looks at him, Tom looks at him and says, Ray, you're not sober. You've never been sober. And I'm giving you this phone number so you can call me before you drink. Because if you call me after you drink, I'm hanging up the phone. 2 days later, and this is the way Ray would tell the story, I found myself in a gin mill in New York City. He orders the drink. The drink and the change come on the bar, and he remembers what this guy said. So he says, well, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to call him now when I'm not shit-faced so he'll know where I am. And this way he'll be able to pick me up when I'm really, when I can't tell my name. This is the story, and this was Ray's initial coming to believe story, which also changed my life by listening to it. He went to the phone booth. By the way, a phone booth is something we used to have. Used to put a nickel or a dime in it back then. Like we're Superman change. So he called the guy. I had one of these things, you know. He called him up, and this is the story. He doesn't know what was said on the phone. He hung up the phone. He walked out of the bar, leaving the drink and the change on the bar, never to drink again. This is a little beach bum alcoholic from Brooklyn, New York City. A power greater than himself intervened because he followed that one simple direction. And by the grace of God, Ray helped thousands upon thousands. Not a day goes by I don't mention his name. And Fred said, not a day. I don't care if I'm in a meeting or sitting with my wife or talking to my kids, because he impacted my life as much as my father, as much as any human being. He was the person, before they had this thing called sober coaches, it was called a sponsor. And he was my sponsor. And he put his hand out to me unconditionally. And there was no time frame that I couldn't talk to him. I didn't have to make an appointment to call him. And I'll tell you what, he totally changed the direction of my life. You know, if you get sober and you stay sober, you're going to read a lot of literature. And I'll just give you something that I read a real long time ago in one of the day-by-day books. And it sums up the third step, the second step, and really the whole program. If you pray, why worry? And if you worry, why bother praying? Because then you're not acknowledging the all-powerfulness of the power. See, God doesn't have any limits to what he can do. You know, our mind has limits, and I can't conceive many of the things that happen and that have happened in my life. But you know what? That's why he's in charge, and I'm not. And the more I can give to him, the happier I am. You know, Ray always said to me, he says, you know, Paul, you can do anything you want in sobriety. I said, what? You can do anything you want. Anything you want. And I say this to everybody here. And then he would wait a minute, and he'd look at me, and he'd say, as long as you're willing to pay the price. Now, sometimes the price is getting loaded. Many of you have done that. Sometimes the price is getting loaded that one time too many. And then you end up either a wet brain, or you kill someone in a blackout, in a car accident. Or you burn down your house when you fall asleep with the cigarette. Let me tell you, if you're here, I promise you this, no matter how bad your story is that got you here, if you pick up, it's going to get a lot worse. And that's not anything I wrote. All you have to do is go home tonight and think about however old you are, whenever you started drinking or drugging, and look where it's taken you from that first cute time of smoking reefer and having a glass of beer. And then the nightmare and the hell and the misery and the degradation that you've subjected yourself to. Well, right now we're telling you you don't have to. But it's not on us to convince you that you don't have to. And I read this a couple of weeks ago also in one of the old pieces of literature that back in the old days, when AA first started, you couldn't just walk into an AA meeting. If you went to wherever they were having the meeting in Akron, Ohio, and where they have the oldest meeting in the world, what you would do is you would walk in, and they would tell you to go upstairs, and you'd go upstairs, and there'd be a couple of the members upstairs. You would have to convince them that you're convinced. Think about that. You would have to go upstairs, with these guys that were sober. And like it says in the fifth chapter, you would probably have to beg them to believe you that you're beat. It's not about, you know, that we're convincing you. Convince us. You know why? Because we're too busy. We don't have enough room for everybody that needs this thing. So the reality is, you had to convince them, and if they felt that you were sincere, then they allowed you to apply for membership. It sounds sick, but that's the way it worked. You know, convince us. Being convinced. So, you know, they used to say, what are you willing to do? And I say that also to you now. What are you willing to do? Are you willing to go to any lengths? Or are you willing to go to most lengths except? And the except, or whatever you put in front of your sobriety, you're guaranteed to lose. That'll be the second thing you lose. The first thing you lose will be your sobriety. And you know, I'm petrified of getting loaded. I mean, they talk about sponsorship being very important. I have had four sponsors. My first sponsor, he's still alive, I love him. He got loaded, and we'll talk about him later in the steps, but now he's sober. You know, he got back in treatment, and he's good, he's sober good. My second sponsor, Fred T, God rest his soul. I was at the 101 Club, and I met him, and I said, could you be my sponsor? And he says, yeah, sure. Gave me his number. He says, do me a favor. I want you to call me every day at 5:30. Just let me know where you were. Let me know where you're going. Let me know how your day was, blah, 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 blah. Okay, you know. I didn't even have a phone when I got sober. I was on one of those pay phones outside of my apartment, and I was calling him up. And I did this for a year and a half. Now, keep in mind, a year and a half later, I'm now an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm sponsoring people. I actually even might have had a job by then. I'm not sure. No. I was still on disability. But I was moving up because I wasn't spending money. And I was living on the Intercoastal in the Bay Colony Club. And I had a little Z car. And I went up to Fred one Sunday at the 101 Club. And I said, Fred, I have a resentment. Now, that's a word you'll learn in here, by the way. I was pissed off. Okay? And he says, what's the matter? I said, Fred, here's the story. I have called you every day for a year and a half. I haven't missed one day. And you haven't called me once. Let me tell you what happened without missing a beat. Fred T had these little horn-rimmed glasses. And he looked at me. I remember like it was yesterday. And it's 34 years ago, 33 years ago. And he was in the aisle there, and he looked at me, and he says, took his glasses off, and he said, you know what, Paul? As soon as you have something I want, I'll be sure to give you a call. He put his glasses back on, and he walked away. Now, if you did that to someone today, they'd report you. Do you know what my sponsor did? He abused my inner child. He shot me. You know, possibly, and that's true. If you want what we have, you do what we did. And if you don't want it, don't worry about it, because you got no chance of getting it. This is not about half measures. If you read that fifth chapter, Ray used to always say to me, half measures availed us nothing. Not half successes, not a quarter of success. Half measures availed us nothing. Zero. I was a zero when I got here, so I don't want to do half measures. The full package. I bought the full package of this deal the day I got here, and I reinvest in that full package every morning because I like the way it's working. I like what's happened to my life. You know, it says in that fifth chapter, we beg of you. Now, if these guys way back, Bill Wilson, the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, if he's writing down in this fifth chapter of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, where it says how it works, and he's writing, we beg of you? I don't know. I think that's probably pretty important. I'm going to tell you a story that was the most recent, not the most recent, one of the most powerful exhibitions of God in my life in the last 10 years. There have been many, but this was the one that sort of convinced my wife of the power of the power. I smoked 3+ packs of cigarettes a day my entire life. When I got sober after a couple, that's when smoking was allowed in meetings, by the way. And I got sober and I tried everything after 5 or 6 years. I tried everything known to man and God to stop smoking. I would pray, I would beg, I would do the Nicorette gums, I would do the patches. I went to a hypnotist. I did this thing where you put holes in the filters, and so you didn't get that much. I did this thing, I would, because I'm always in meetings, it was a beeper, and it would beep like at varying times when you were allowed to have a cigarette, and everybody would be looking at me, and I'd say, oh, your beeper's, I mean, I needed to stop. I couldn't breathe. I was coughing up blood and stuff, and I could not stop. 6.5 years ago, I'm in Long Island, where I spend a lot of the summer. And I wake up in the morning, and I get out of the shower, and I'm like dizzy. You know, I mean, I don't even know what it was, but I was dizzy. So then I come back into the bedroom, and I get dressed. It's early. I go to a 7:30 meeting out there in Long Island in the morning. And I get dressed and I'm walking downstairs and I'm still not feeling right. But I'm certainly not going to wake my wife. And I'm not, you know, no big deal. I go to the meeting. And as I'm driving there, I'm not feeling right. I don't tell anyone in the meeting. I call a friend of mine and I told him what was happening. He says, you better get to the emergency room right now. He says, that's very dangerous. So I said, I will, but I'm meeting some people in Goldberg's Bagels first. No, we had a breakfast that we have in the morning. So I went to Goldberg's, and then after that, it's like 10:30, and I call my wife, and I say, honey, I tell her what's happening. She says, all right, we got to go to Southampton Hospital. We go to the hospital, and this is what happened. I tell them the symptoms. They immediately admit me. They put me on the second floor, the heart attack and stroke floor. They hooked me all up to everything, and they thought I had a mini stroke. They called it a TIA. So, you know, whatever it was, they put me in the bed with all of the wires and everything on me. And then later that day, the doctor comes in, you know, from wherever he came from. And he looks at me and he tests me and he asks me and this and that. He says, all right, tomorrow morning, we're going to do a CAT scan, an MRI, we're doing the whole deal. He says, and we're checking brain waves and everything in your brain because something looks like it just isn't right based on everything you're saying. He's walking out of the room. And he turns around and he says to me, he says, you smoke, right? I say, yeah, smoke 3 packs a day. He says, you know what I'm also going to do? I'm going to also do a CAT scan and an MRI of your lung. I said, well, why would you do that? I thought you said it's in my brain. He says, well, there's a chance that you have lung cancer that's spread to your brain. And he walks out of the room. Now, let me tell you something. This guy is certainly not going to get the award for bedside manner of the year. My wife was sitting right there by me, and she says, I never saw you that white in my whole life. So now I'm really petrified. I mean, I'm not kidding. I say to her, I say, honey, it looks like I played the hand out too long. You know, I kept thinking that one day I'd stop. The next morning, I'm down there in the MRI place. And I've had MRIs before, but because this was going to be a lot more stuff, I decided that I better, like, get a lot different prayers working. And I was very scared. So I said, you know, instead of the normal prayers, I'll do the third step prayer. And I do part of the prayer of St. Francis and I, you know, whatever. This particular time, this was crunch time. I'm petrified. Here's exactly what I said. I'm in the tube, and I say the following. I say, God, I can't stop smoking. You know that I can't stop smoking. I've tried everything that has ever been invented. They came out with this thing called Zyban. It was a pill. I tried to take it. It drove me crazy. I mean, whatever they came out with, I did, because I wanted so badly to stop, but I hadn't surrendered. So here was this almost unconditional surrender. I said in this tube, I said, God, look, you know that I can't do this. As a matter of fact, and I've never made a deal with God before, this was the deal that I made with God. I said, here's what I'll do. I'll do the best I can not to buy a pack of cigarettes. And you're going to have to do everything else. That was in August of 19, August 6.5 years ago. I came out of that MRI machine. I've never picked up a cigarette since that day. Now, let me tell you something. My wife, who only heard my story of my first meeting and seeing Mark and the people and never picking up a drug, well, she only heard that story. This story she saw. This story she experienced. This story she witnessed. This story she would freak out that I would smoke everywhere. I mean, you know, people would say, when we'd be out, they'd say, oh, you let him smoke in the house? And I would look at them, what do you mean, whose house is it? I mean, you know, you let him smoke in the car? Every one of my cars smelled like a crack gallery. I was smoking around the clock. This car I have has never had a cigarette in it. It was gone. It was removed because I begged. I begged, and this is what I was taught. Any sincere cry for help is heard for and answered by God. This was a sincere cry for help. I was petrified. And I'm not suggesting that you make a deal, you know. But somehow in that case with me, it worked. You know, I was taught also by these two people, Ray and Fred, that a grateful alcoholic won't drink. Now, grateful is not a word, it's an action. You know, I introduce myself as being grateful. So what? It's just a freaking word. Grateful is that I'm willing to go out of my way for someone else with no thought of return. I had some things to do today, and yet I got a text message from a friend of mine's son, Kenny Kane's son, Christopher Kane. And he said, my dad is in Delray Beach Medical Center. He fell. I didn't even think about it. I put everything I had to do on the back burner, and I went to Delray Beach Medical Center. That's what we do. That's all we're paid to do, by not getting paid. That's how I don't get paid. by doing something like that. Because the only thing for me is to give back the love that I was given with no thought of return. That's what happened. These guys didn't want anything from me. I didn't have anything to give them. They just wanted to see the miracle happen in me, because it reaffirmed the miracle that happened in them. And that's why I keep doing this. That's why I keep suiting up and showing up. Just for the record, tomorrow, I mean, I'm looking around the room, there's a few of you. Tomorrow night is a very big holiday. I mean, it's a big holiday for everyone. It's Good Friday, but it's also Passover. And Passover in the Jewish religion is, the only thing we celebrate is miracles. And that's what this was. It was a miracle that we passed over. We had one little thing of oil that lasted 8 days and was only 1 day's worth. So way, way back, by blind faith, by what they said to each other, they said, well, look, what are we going to do? We could either use the dirty oil, because they could mix it with some dirty oil. We could do that, or we could trust the process and use today's oil today. The pure oil, we'll use it today, and we just got to believe that God's going to take care of us. Well, you know what? That oil lasted for 8 days. Blind faith became trust. The trust became unconditional. And the last thing I'm going to say to you, because Fred said it every time, has anybody told you they loved you yet today? I hope so. But if not, let me be the first. I love you all. Thanks for listening.